Hilma Wallitzer's new novel, The Doctor's Daughter, begins as a middle-aged woman awakes with a feeling of dread and isn't sure what's causing it. Is it her marriage, her children, or her father's Alzheimer's disease? As the novel progresses, she examines her life for the answer. Wallitzer didn't publish her first novel until she was in her mid-40s. The Doctor's Daughter is her seventh novel, but it's the first she's written in more than a decade. The main character's father in The Doctor's Daughter is based in part on Wallitzer's parents, who both had dementia before they died. In the novel, the main character, Alice, describes herself as witnessing the gradual death of her father's personality. I asked Wallitzer if there were aspects of her parents' personalities that remained intact or became even more pronounced during the period of dementia.
The sweetness that my mother always exhibited became more pronounced. Even as she lost the ability to talk, it was in her facial expressions, the way she looked at me when I came into a room. You know, there was this brightness of recognition. Of course, that eventually faded, too. And my father, who was somewhat irritable, became more irritable. I saw that happen as well. And the main thing was is that you lose them twice. You lose the parent you knew and loved and depended upon, and then you learn to love the parent they become, the one who's dependent upon you. And then you get ready to lose that person, too.
Did this make you think a lot about which parts of personality are just innate to a person and which parts are shaped by everything around them, their upbringing, their environment, and so on? Because they're like,
yeah.
Your mother's sweetness, did you come to think that that was just something innate to her?
I think it was the way shyness is. There are certain things change. According to the environment. The environment of a nursing home, which isn't always conducive to feeling good about yourself. You're in a very public situation. You don't have the kind of privacy you had. So certain aspects of their deterioration of their personality was due to the environment, I think, to that lack of privacy, to exposure to other people, having their own dementia, the kind of screaming that went on in that situation. It wasn't like home, for sure.
Did it hurt you to leave after a visit to the institution where they were?
It hurt me to come in and to leave. In the book, Alice cries when her father is being undressed and put to bed for the first time. She felt as if she had betrayed him in some terrible way. And I felt the same way. It happened that my father was very high and euphoric on antipsychotics, so I was in the hallway crying, and he was singing at the top of his lungs in the other room and seemed to be having a good time. So it sort of made me laugh a little and cry at the same time. But when I left them, I have to say, I felt very free and happy about resuming my own life, about going home, going to the library, reading a book, seeing my family, eating with sentient friends.
How much time had you spent caring for them before taking them to a 24-hour facility?
Well, only my father went to the 24-hour facility. My mother had a stroke, and I took care of them as they gradually deteriorated for about 17 years.
In your home,
and my father was
in their home?
It was in their home, and we arranged for caretakers, but I was on the scene as well and on the phone all the time as well. And the phone calls got really peculiar, as they do with Alice's father. They become more frequent, they become more repetitive, and then they start coming in the middle of the night, and that's when you really get scared.
Mm-hmm. You know, as much as she is upset when she brings her father to the nursing home, she decides to take him out one day for just like a little trip, a little visit. And things go so badly. And she's so overwhelmed by the responsibility and by his lack of ability to really be in the world that she's so grateful when she returns him back home to the nursing home.
Yeah, I felt that way, too. We took my father out for a visit, to visit my mother, actually, and it was a very tragic situation. We got stuck in traffic. He thought he was in an elevator. He wanted to get out, and it was very similar. My book is not autobiographical. I'm not Alice. This isn't about my marriage, but there are certain details that I've taken from life, like the father's deterioration.
My guest is Hilma Wallitzer, and her new novel is called The Doctor's Daughter. You published your first novel when you were 44, which is relatively late in life to have a first novel for somebody who goes on to become, you know, a really respected novelist. What made you decide so relatively late in life to write a novel?
I had been writing short stories and publishing them, but I erroneously believed that the short story was the adolescence of a writer and the novel was her maturity. So I tried to write a novel, and lo and behold, I did. But once I did that, it was very hard to go back to the short story. When that novel came out, I was really quite a dedicated domestic person. And in the print interviews I did, the headline read, "Housewife Turns Into Writer." And I was so worried after this 12-year hiatus that if I did any more interviews, it would say, "Writer turns back into housewife."
Well, what did you do for the 12 years you weren't writing?
A lot of reading. I'd like to say I went to medical school or that I had amnesia, but I'm afraid, you know, that's not true. I did a lot of anguishing about not writing. I woke up every day thinking, oh, no, another day without writing. And I would sit down at the typewriter and later the computer and try to write. And there were times I fell asleep doing it because I wasn't inspired. I didn't have a character telling me her story the way I did with this one.
So you'd sit down and feel like you were forcing it?
Uh-huh, exactly. I was forcing it, and if you don't want to write it, nobody's going to want to read it. It's when it comes out. This book came so quickly and so fluently that I feel that it was probably being written in some unconscious way, that I was writing, even though I wasn't putting it down.
My guest is writer Hilma Wallitzer. Her new novel is called The Doctor's Daughter. Last year, I spoke with her daughter, Meg Wallitzer, who's also a writer and had just published her novel, The Position. It's about a family in which the young children find out their parents are the authors of a best-selling sex manual similar to The Joy of Sex. The novel follows the members of the family and examines how this book affects their lives. Here's a brief excerpt of that interview with Meg, in which I asked about her mother. Now, your mother is a writer, Hilma Wallitzer, and yes. I'm wondering, like, when you were young, did you come across sex scenes of hers, and what impact did that have on you?
Yes, that had an impact as well. I mean, these things all kind of came together in my mind to gestate for a long time until I wrote The Position. But when I was a teenager, in junior high school, actually, my mother sold her first novel, Ending, and it was a wonderful literary book, but it did have a pretty graphic sex scene in it. And I remember going to school that day, and a bunch of boys had a copy of the book, and they ran down the hallway shouting, "Read page 108, read page 108. And I pretty much went home to my mother and said, "Why couldn't you be a travel agent?" I mean, in the suburb where we lived, nobody's mother was a novelist. Everybody's mother was a travel agent or a real estate agent or a housewife. This was something pretty unusual that she did.
That's Meg Wallitzer talking about my guest, her mother, Hilma Wallitzer. And Hilma Wallitzer has a new novel called The Doctor's Daughter. Well, Hilma, did you worry about, well, what if my daughter reads this scene on page 108?
No, I didn't. I couldn't worry about all those things. Otherwise, you just stop writing. I remember my mother calling and saying, "Well, your novel is very nice, dear, but your aunts are going to be very upset about the language you use."
Did you care about what your aunts would think?
No, I didn't really.
And another thing that Meg says here that's really interesting is that when you're a kid, you want your novel, you want your mother to be like everybody else's mother. I think when you get older, you so appreciate what's unique about your parents. But, you know, when you're young, you want them to be like everyone else.
Well, I tried to be like everyone else in the important ways and the nurturing ways, but I had to be my own self. I had to be that writer. As soon as they went off to school, I went right to the typewriter in my bathrobe and had my secret life.
It sounds like maybe it took you a while before you gave yourself permission to do what you really wanted to do and to have that secret life.
Definitely. Definitely. And the women's movement had a great deal to do with it. It really did give me permission. I felt before that, if I've talked about trying to write, I was be treated like a talented housewife. That same image came back into play. But once I published, everything changed. People took me more seriously. I remember telling my father about my first short story being published in the Saturday Evening Post, and he was deeply impressed. He said, "Why, I read that at the dentist."
So it kind of existed in his world.
Yes. Before that, it was just something I did when I wasn't cooking or talking on the phone to them, when I wasn't raising the children.
You said the women's movement helped you reach the point where you could say, I want to write and I'm going to try and do it. What aspect of the women's movement? Was it books that you read, a consciousness-raising group that you were in, just what was in the air? I mean, what was it exactly?
I didn't belong to a consciousness-raising group. It was The Feminine Mystique, which was a very important book in my development. I didn't belong to a consciousness-raising group, but Meg did. She and a group of little friends met at the house, and they wouldn't let me come in because I said, well, why not? I'm a woman, too. And they said, yes, but we talk about our mothers. That's what their consciousness-raising group was about, was complaining about their mothers.
How old was she then?
Oh, I guess she was a teenager, a young teenager.
So if it wasn't a consciousness-raising group, it was Betty Friedan's book, The Feminine Mystique.
Ms. Magazine. There was something in the air. People began talking about it, and I saw friends. I didn't know any other writers, but I saw friends restlessly looking for something else to do that wasn't making Jell-O, that wasn't just picking the kids up at school or going to brownie meetings. Everybody seemed to be looking for something else. And it's really odd because it was as if I broke a contract that I had made.
What kind of contract?
My mother had raised me to get married and have children.
But your children were pretty mature by then, right?
Well, they were in school when I started writing short stories. Mm-hmm. They were both in school. That seemed convenient. But even then, I was expected, or I thought I was expected, to be home doing certain things. And I was the mother who made costumes. I think my kids were really relieved when I finally became a full-time writer because I stopped forcing them to be the headless horseman, as the character is in my book, for Halloween when they just wanted that store-bought princess costume. And I was always decorating their birthday cakes until they collapsed. I think I was putting all that creative energy into my domestic life. And then when I put it all into my writing, I think everybody was relieved to have less attention paid to them, to have more freedom.
Was it fulfilling when you were putting it in your domestic life?
Yes, it actually was. And I have to say, this is probably sounds like a non-feminist thing to say, but when I'd clean a closet, for instance, I felt almost the same way I did as when I finished a short story. I had organized something in the short story, my thoughts in the closet, my blouses and skirts. I had cleaned out stuff I wasn't going to wear, which is equivalent to editing. There seemed to be an analogy.
I like that. So when you decided you wanted to write, you took a writing workshop that was taught by Anatole Breuillard, who was a great writer and later became a book critic for the New York Times. I think you studied with him before he'd become a book critic?
Yes, yes. He was amazing as a teacher, too, because when I came to that class, I had very little self-confidence. And what little I had was almost destroyed that first night. He had me come to the front of the class and read my short story aloud in a very crowded classroom at the New School in New York. And then he called on people for comments, and the first man said, "That was the most boring thing I ever heard in my life." And I was ready to pack it in, just go home and make Jell-O for the rest of my life. And Anatole slipped me a note, which I still have, and it said, "The story is fine. Congratulations. See me later." And he just said, "You don't belong in this class," and he put me into an advanced class, where I read the same story the following week. They didn't like it much either, but they said constructive and helpful things about it. And eventually I did publish that story.
Did you revise it a lot from the version that you'd read in class?
Yes, definitely. And revision is what workshops are about. I always tell my workshops the purpose of this class is revision, not suicide.
Yeah, that's really great, great advice. Did you feel close to like packing it in after the criticisms you got that first time?
Definitely. I remember trembling, and really, first of all, it was very embarrassing to have to read my story aloud in front of all these people. Believe it or not, I was shy in those days. I don't think I could have yelled fire in a crowded theater without feeling self-conscious. And it was hard enough to do that, to finally do it. And I read it so quickly, I hyperventilated. And I read it just like a laundry list without any expression. And then to have it so brutally criticized. And I remember Anatole saying to the person who criticized it, well, wasn't there anything you liked? And I thought, well, I don't want this guy to throw me a bone. That was the last thing I wanted. But what he was showing was how important it is to find whatever is good in a piece of work, so to encourage the writer to do more of that. Anybody could point out what's bad in it, but if you can find that one gem, that one good sentence in an otherwise lost story, you can help that writer to harness that and use it again.
I would imagine that, like most writing teachers and editors, he recommended that you always go for the truth of the story or the truth of the experience, the truth of the emotion, whether it was fiction or nonfiction that you were writing, to kind of go deep down to that larger truth. What was it like for you when you learned that he had kept a secret all his life? And the secret was that he was actually African-American passing for white. And I'm just wondering what your reaction to that was and when it was that you learned that.
Well, Skip Gates asked me that question before he was...
This is the writer Henry Louis Gates.
Yes, when he was writing his piece for The New Yorker about Anatole and about the exposure of his background. And in thinking about it, I realized I knew for years. I knew his sacred secret. And we just never talked about it because
he didn't want to talk about it.
I guess it was in the atmosphere. People talked about it. I had heard it.
So it was a kind of known secret.
Yes, it was a known secret. There was a novel in which he was supposedly exposed, where he was a character who tried to pass. And we all knew about it, but we didn't really discuss it very much. There was so much else that was important about him, that was vital about him to us, his intelligence, his generosity to us as students, his brilliance, his creativity, his own gift for writing. He wrote a wonderful story called What the Cystoscope Said. And Gates's premise was that he never developed fully as a writer, never went on to write the great novel that the early stories promised he would, because he was shielding that secret. But I tended to think that the block he had, and it was a kind of block or an inhibition, may have been due to something else, or he may just have wasted himself and wasted his talent in conversation because he was sparkling in the classroom.
Yeah, some people really say don't talk about what you're writing and don't maybe even talk too much while you're writing. Save it.
Right. Well, we always heard all those things. I don't know why I didn't write for 12 years. I'm not positive. It felt like a terminal block, but as I said, I may have been writing all along, and I was living my life during that time. Life gets in the way, but I think that's kind of a whiny excuse, because I wrote during stressful or busy times before this. So I don't know what got in the way now, but I'm just so glad it's over. It's wonderful to be writing again.
Well, Hilma Wolitzer, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Hilma Wolitzer's new novel is called The Doctor's Daughter. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org, where you'll also find a link to my interview with her daughter, novelist Meg Wolitzer.